To badquaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone. This is podcast number 195, and it is for Monday, August 27th, 2012. I'm actually recording this on Saturday, the 25th of August, because I have with me today a very special guest, Robert P. Murphy, legendary economist. And before I get into interviewing Robert, I want to touch the subject that I've talked about at the beginning of each podcast for a little while. I want to just give you an update in case you haven't heard the last few podcasts. The company Notions 3 is going to be completely redoing our website, so we're going to have a whole new look and feel and a lot of new bells and whistles and doodads and gadgets and whatnots. So keep an eye open for that. The company name is Notion 3, and they're kind enough to do this for us because they support what we're doing, and we really appreciate them for doing that. Now, Robert Murphy is he's probably the most hip-hop happening economist in the world right now. He is he was very popular at Porkfest. There are pictures floating around of Bob Murphy at Porkfest, surrounded by beautiful women, because that's what happens anytime Bob Murphy shows up someplace. He's a chick magnet. They just come at him from every direction. He is a PhD graduate from New York University, a BA from Hillsdale. He has a website that's very simple. It's consultingbyrpm.com. That's consulting by Robert P. Murphy, rpm.com. He has written several books, Chaos Theory, which I read and I loved, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism, which I read and I loved, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal, which I read and I loved, Lessons for the Young Economist. I have not read that, but I did listen to a lecture series on it. How Privatized Banking Really Works, Integrating Austrian Economics with the Infinite Banking Concept. I have not read that, but I plan to. Bob has also designed a home course study in Austrian economics, and he wrote the study guide for Murray Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State with Power and Market. And I have to tell you, Man, Economy, and State is one of my favorite books. When I got into Power and Markets, it really bogged me down, and it was really making my brain hurt. So what I need to do is pick up Bob Murphy's guide to that, and maybe it'll help me a little bit. He also wrote a guide to Ludwig von Mises's Human Action. And again, I have to say, trying to get through Human Action, wow, is like swimming through Jell-O for me. It was really stretching my intellectual capabilities. So I probably should go back and take a look at Bob Murphy's guide on that. In addition to all of the above, Robert Murphy appeared before the House Committee on Financial Services, and I certainly hope he washed well afterwards. Bob, welcome to the show. Welcome to badquaker.com. And there, after reading all of that and all your accomplishments and everyone knowing who you are and sitting in on your wonderful lectures and talks at the Mises Institute and at Porkfest and other places like this, the one burning question that everybody wants to know: how many karaoke bars have you actually been thrown out of?
Well, thank you for the kind introduction. I'm trying to think. I've certainly closed several karaoke bars. I don't know that I've ever actually been thrown out.
And I say that in case you don't know, Bob has a great sense of humor, and that's why I was teasing him about being such a chick magnet and all that. He does have a great sense of humor, and he's on the younger side. You're what, 36, Bob?
Yeah, but I don't look a day over 44.
You know, you think a lot of times a person thinks of an economist, and they think of an old man with a beard and maybe a cane. Oh, wait, that's me. But I'm not an economist. I'm what might be called what do you call it, with a football fan who critiques the quarterback, an armchair. I'm an armchair economist. I don't really know what I'm doing, but I have a lot of opinions about it. But Bob's the real deal. And let's start out with what might be considered an easy question. Explain to my listeners what quantitative easing is.
Well, sure. So quantitative easing, actually, believe it or not, even professional economists, they don't agree necessarily what the term means. So the way I use it, and I think a lot of economists agree with it, the idea is that typically, if you remember before this crisis set in, when the Fed would do something, the newspapers would report it as, oh, the Fed cut interest rates. You know, oh, the Federal Reserve meeting met today, and they announced that they'll cut interest rates from 5% down to 4.5%, that sort of thing. Well, once interest rates got down to basically zero, then they couldn't do any more of that. And so that's when they started announcing how much money they were going to spend. So if you think back, you never in a press conference or reading a newspaper account or anything ever heard the Fed say, we're going to buy X billion dollars worth of government bonds, you know, before this crisis kicked in. They would always just talk about what their interest rate target would be. And they really didn't even like talking about the fact that it involved them buying stuff, because then that might make people start wondering about how they got the money to do that. Whereas now in this crisis, because they want to show that they're doing something, they're throwing around the numbers saying we're going to buy whatever, $300 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities. So I think that's the way I use the term, and a lot of economists do also, that the quantitative in the term quantitative easing refers to the fact that they're talking about how much money they're going to spend, how much they're going to expand their balance sheet.
Now, when they do that, what they're essentially doing is creating a big dump of new money and pushing it into the market, right?
Oh, exactly right. And this is something that newcomers to this area, they don't believe you when you first tell them. Like, they think that you're dumbing it down for them and that really there must be something more to it. But no, modern central banks that just have fiat currencies that aren't tied up to anything else, when they want to go buy assets, they just write checks on themselves, or, you know, they do it electronically through computers. And it's the equivalent of literally writing a check. You know, Ben Bernanke writes a check for $1 million drawn on the Federal Reserve and gives it to somebody, takes $1 million worth of assets, and that person puts the check in his bank, and now that bank's balance with the Fed has gone up by $1 million. And you say, well, where did that $1 million come from? It didn't come from anywhere. It just got created magically, because the Fed cannot bounce a check by definition.
And one of the things that some people don't really realize, And I think maybe people on the other side of this equation, you know, people on the banking side of it, the thing that they maybe do realize but they don't want to admit is that money is a commodity just like any other commodity. So if we're talking about corn, or we're talking about soybeans, or we're talking about any commodity, its value is based on how much of it that there is, and how what the desire and what the need of it for it is, right?
Well, right. Yes. I mean, supply and demand work on the money good just like they work on other things. I mean, money is special because of why people want to hold it, and why you would demand money for different reasons than why you would demand corn, obviously. But in terms of the basic laws of economics and what determines the unit price of something, yeah, the supply and demand works for money just like for anything else.
So the more of it that there is, the less valuable that it is.
But, right. Exactly.
And another thing, since we are on fiat currency, all this is fiat basically literally means I believe it to be so. It's kind of like the word amen. It's like it's an act of faith to believe in it. So really we're talking about we believe that the value of money is what it is because we believe it is what it is, right?
Right. So it used to be the case that the dollar and other major currencies were tied in some way to the precious metals. And people who have been born in the modern age don't even remember that, but it used to be the case. And so the term fiat money in this context means that the dollar and the euro and so forth, they're not backed up by anything. As you say, it's when you say, well, why do we value the dollar? Why does it – when I sell an hour of my labor to get $40 from somebody – why am I doing that? And ultimately the reason is simply that, well, because you think you're going to be able to trade those dollars for something else down the road. It's not because the dollar is a claim on anything else in a legal sense.
Now, there's a lot of, people kick around things like, so-and-so is a gold bug, or so-and-so believes in the gold standard or whatever. And this is usually said with a negative connotation, like, you must be some kind of backward hick that married your cousin if you believe that gold is, you know, whatever. But in all actuality, let me put it this way. One of the complaints with the possibility of having a gold standard, people come up and they say, there's just not enough gold in existence to support all the money supply, so it wouldn't work out. And that little simple answer, and they just throw off the idea of gold-backed money. What would you say to a person like that?
Well, it's typically the person who says that, I get the sense, doesn't really know how the gold standard actually operated. And I think that more often than not, someone who throws that objection in your face doesn't really understand the system. And that just sounds like a profound way to just diffuse the whole argument. But in terms of, practically speaking, I can't give you a generic answer because it would depend on what the specific proposal would be. So some proposals for going back on gold would say, you just take the total number of outstanding dollars in existence at the moment when the reform kicks in. And then look at how much gold the Federal Reserve and the U.S. federal government have in their stockpiles, and then it's just a division problem. And then they say, in order to have the outstanding dollars be backed up 100% by gold, this is the new ratio that we're going to establish. And so we now promise we will always be able to if you turn in dollar bills, we'll give you this much gold in exchange. So there's no question of is there enough gold, because they're picking the peg rate, the exchange rate, to make sure that they have enough. Now, where the problem is, though, with that, and this is like if the critic is somewhat sophisticated, they might mean is they could say, right now, for example, with the market price of gold, what it is, that doesn't reflect. If you took all the dollars in the world and divided by how much gold there is, the number wouldn't be close to what the current market price is. So that's what they mean, that if you were going to go that route that I just suggested a few minutes ago, then the federal government would end up saying something like, if you give us $20,000 of gold, we'll give you if you give us $20,000 in currency, we'll give you 1 ounce of gold. And of course, that's, much different from what the current market price of gold is. So what they would be saying is that's not really tying the hands of the government for a long time. So not to get too technical, but Ludwig von Mises actually had a very intriguing proposal where he just said lock in the current market price of gold, and then in order to issue any new currency, you have to first have someone come and deposit that market price amount of gold in bullion, and then you give a new currency. So it doesn't make us go to 100% gold backing overnight. It just means from this point forward, any new dollars that get printed are backed up 100% by gold at this new official exchange rate. And so over time, this system tends toward 100% backing.
Mm-hmm. And now technically, it really doesn't matter how much gold there is. Let's say we had a new mineral that was discovered on an asteroid somewhere, and would just make up
unobtainium?
Hey, there you go. That's a good one. You do this for a living, so you can you deal with these questions all the time. Okay, so we find this new mineral, and there's only 1 ounce in existence that we know of anywhere in the universe. And so if there's only 1 ounce of it, we could still use that as a commodity money and have the entire monetary system based on that. It's just a matter of dividing it up and letting the market divide it up. And what I'm saying is the quantity of gold doesn't matter. It could be 1 ounce of whatever that was that you just said. theoretically, is that possible?
Oh yeah. And Milton Friedman actually talked about that a lot. And it's not even that you'd have to physically break it up, that you could just have that 1 ounce sitting, in a vault somewhere in a bank. And then what the bank would issue is, claim tickets on it, like demand deposits that are claims on that particular thing. And so, so you could subdivide it even to be smaller than the molecular or atomic, if it's an element, size. And so, yeah. The general answer to this complaint about there's not enough gold is to say you would just change what the exchange rate was or the purchasing power. And so it's true. I mean, if there were only one atom of something, that wouldn't be a good money because that's just so inconvenient. And the prices would have to be priced in such odd units that it would be weird. You might as well just use something else where there's more of the stuff. But strictly speaking, those are just matters of convenience. It's not like there's some conceptual problem that, oh, we need to have a certain amount of gold also, or else it won't work.
And I think a lot of people don't realize that that is what dollars used to be. They used to be a certificate for something that was on deposit. And they it even said that on the old dollar bills and old, you know, $5 bills and $10 bills and so forth.
Right. I encourage people, if they've never seen it, just go to Wikipedia and look up gold certificate. And you can see things like it looks like it's a $50 bill, except it doesn't just say, Federal Reserve note. It says this is to certify. I'm paraphrasing, but it says something like this is to certify that $50 in gold coin is now being stored at the United States Treasury, and the bearer of this note can receive it upon demand. So, other than, I mean, it still has the same precedence and stuff, and it looks like it's U.S. currency, but when you read the actual wording. You're right. It was not just saying this is a note that happens to be issued by the Treasury or something. It was saying this is a claim ticket. You go and turn this in and you get $50 worth of gold coin or silver, or silver if you looked up a silver certificate.
Going back to quantitative easing, I assume you expect there to be more quantitative easing in the future.
Yeah. I mean, they might not call it that because in certain circles, it has a bad connotation at this point, but certainly I expect them to buy more assets and expand the Fed's balance sheet.
And what that basically does is drive more inflation, right?
Right. So for Austrian economists, and I'm part of that school, our definition of inflation means that them creating more money, and typically it comes in through the banking sector. So, but then also, yes, it leads to what the general public typically means by the word inflation, by which they mean prices rising. And yes, those two go hand in hand. So to answer your question more broadly, I think they're going to, every time there's any hiccup in the economy and it looks like the things are turning down again, and especially if the big banks get in trouble, I think they're just going to keep creating more money. And the only reason they would stop doing that is if prices started really rising and then the public started getting upset. And so far, they seem to have been able to get away with it. I mean, certain commodity prices went through the roof, but it's still the case when people go to the store, it's not like bread's $10 a loaf yet. And so I think until that happens, they would just keep doing what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Because literally inflation, in the way that we look at it, inflation means to inflate the amount of dollars that exist. And then the result of that is higher prices because the dollar is worth less. It's not that the price of bread has gone up. Bread is always the same value from, like, you know, 2 BC to today. It's pretty much the same value. But the value of the means of exchange, the money that we're using, changes, and therefore it gives the illusion that the price of the bread has changed. Is that goofy or is that about right?
I think you're looking at it the right way. That's an important point you make, that over time, actually, in many respects, economically, goods and services become more abundant. So they become cheaper in a sort of technological sense, meaning like how many hours of your labor do you have to get up to get enough food to eat for the day? That number trends down over time. Mm-hmm. And certainly how many hours do you have to work in order to get an automobile with certain attributes or to get a certain amount of storage power on your computer? Clearly that number has plummeted as technology improves. But why do prices quoted in dollars tend to go up over the 20th century? Well, as you say, it's because they keep making dollars faster than we make goods, real goods and services. So it's not surprising that the dollar price of those things keeps going up.
Now, some have said that the Austrians are wrong on everything that they're saying and everything that they have said simply because hyperinflation hasn't hit yet. It's kind of like if you were saying, like, guys, you're headed right towards this cliff, and somebody refutes that by saying, you're crazy, we haven't gone over the cliff yet. But that's kind of the way they're thinking. To me, that's the way I describe their thinking when they say that the Austrians are wrong simply because hyperinflation hasn't hit yet. How would you take that question?
Yeah, it's a good question to bring up, a good topic. Right. I think in general, that's an unfair thing to say because it wasn't, I mean, I certainly wasn't, and most of the prominent Austrian economists that I know I don't remember any of them coming out and literally saying, oh, there's going to be hyperinflation. They would instead, they would say things like, if we don't get off of this path, the only result is eventually going to be hyperinflation. That, yeah, you can keep printing money every time there's a problem in the banking sector, but ultimately that will destroy the currency. You know, so those are the types of statements they were making. Now, it's true, some provocative people, maybe to get headlines or something, might have put the word hyperinflation in a blog post. But then when you go and read their actual analysis, they were saying things more along the lines of what I'm saying. So, I mean, one way to think of it is, even if all the money that Bernanke has printed that largely right now is still bottled up in the banking sector, even if that all got lent out, and even if the demand to hold dollars got cut in half because the public, you know, all of a sudden the dollar lost its status as the world's reserve currency and so forth, I mean, the most you're talking about would be like a 50 times increase in the price level, which would be catastrophic. But that's not what people usually mean by the term hyperinflation. You know, when people say hyperinflation, they mean like 100,000% increase in prices in 1 year and that sort of thing. So they would have to print a lot more to get genuine hyperinflation of the kind we've seen historically in certain places. And so that may well still happen. But the point was, the Austrians were saying, if we continue down this path, this is the inevitable outcome. Don't think that we're going to be able to print just the right amount in order to fix things. That's a fool's dream.
And you mentioned something there, too, that's important, and a lot of people may not realize it. You mentioned how much money is still bottled up in the banking system that is not actually out affecting the economy. Explain that a little bit for us.
Well, sure. And this actually ties back in with what you were asking there, that part of what happened, because Bernanke, since the fall of 2008, has more than tripled the Fed's balance sheet. So what I mean is, in terms of creating new dollars out of thin air, in that process we described earlier, where he just writes checks and buys assets from people and this gives them money that he just generated in that transaction itself, Bernanke has added more to the system, more than twice as much than all previous Fed presidents combined, just to give an idea of how much he has injected into the financial sector. And so part of what the critics say when they say that the Austrians are crazy for worrying about this is, like, well, what's the big deal? When you go to the grocery store, yeah, food's a little bit more expensive, but it's not like prices tripled or anything the way you all crazy Austrians are warning about. And so part of what happened logistically is that because the banks are in such dire straits, because their balance sheets were so awful and they were capital constrained, even though they had all of this liquidity that Bernanke flooded the sector with, and they had the legal permission to make a bunch more new loans to people, they chose not to. So in normal times, when the Fed wants to expand its balance sheet and create money out of thin air, the commercial banks then take that injection and then go pyramid more loans on top of it. And so if the Fed creates $1 million, the private commercial banks might create another $9 million on top of it in new loans. That leg of the process hasn't happened very much in this crisis, because Bernanke pumps in new money and then the commercial banks just sit on it because they don't want to make new loans for other reasons. So there's more than $1 trillion at this point in what's called excess reserves, meaning money that the banks are sitting on that they have the legal permission to lend out to new customers who want new deposits, but they're just choosing not to.
We're going to go into a break here, and I'm going to save the file so that it doesn't crash or anything. And while we're going into the break, you can listen to one of our wonderful commercials. And Bob and I are going to stretch our legs, and then we're going to be right back and pick back up on this topic. I'd like to talk to you about Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. The Liberty Classroom is a collection of courses on history and Austrian economics presented in an easy, convenient way. There are video files and audio files you can download. You can participate in discussions online in the discussion boards. And there are live sessions with Tom Woods and the other educators where you can directly interact with the instructors. Now, who is this for? It's for anyone who realizes that they didn't get the real story in government-approved schools. It's also great for homeschoolers and unschoolers. Join Tom Woods and his team, and they'll equip you with one of the very best tools the Liberty Movement has to offer, knowledge. Real knowledge in a usable form. At Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, you can get all this for only $99 a year. Now that's less than the cost of one movie DVD a month. This gets you access to absolutely everything on their site. all the courses plus additional courses that will be added later, the discussion forums, the live sessions, everything. So how do you do this? You go to badquaker.com. You click on the banner for Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom. By using that link, you'll let Tom know that I sent you, and you'll help keep badquaker.com on the internet. Thank you very much. And welcome back to badquaker.com. With me is renowned among us, among the especially among the anarcho-capitalist community, but economist Robert Murphy. And I shouldn't really have to make any kind of introduction. I played with him a minute ago in teasing him out so that I could tease him about karaoke. But you ought to know who Bob Murphy is without me saying, if you're part of the anarcho-capitalist movement there. Bob, off the subject that we were talking about a second ago, let me kind of pin you down a little bit. How do you consider yourself? Do you consider yourself as a... I know an economist kind of has to separate his political views from the reality of his job, so to speak. But how do you classify yourself politically?
Oh, well, among people who would know what the term means, I have no problem saying I'm an anarcho-capitalist, if that's what you're asking.
Mm-hmm. So then you smash windows, right?
Only when I hit the really high notes. And then... I mean, I also, like on Facebook, for example, there are a lot of my friends from high school and just growing up that are on there that aren't, or I don't know what their political backgrounds are. So a lot of times there, I'll refer to myself as a libertarian. You know, I don't like to overload people with political posts on Facebook anyway, but if I ever am going to allude to that stuff, I won't call myself an anarchist just for the reason you say that. A lot of them are going to say, what, you're going around smashing McDonald's up? You know, and that's just not... obviously, what we mean by the term. So with them, I might use libertarian with a small L to get them to understand the sort of where I'm coming from. It depends what the context is and what the group is. With other people, I might call myself a voluntarist or something like that, just if I think that they'll know what I mean by that term.
Right. One way or the other, what we're talking about is the embracing of the zero aggression principle and understanding of Lockean property rights and believing that that is the best alternative for society, right?
Right. And I mean, I also am religious and I'm a Christian. And so with that kind of crowd, you know, I might push it and say, hey, you know, we agree that men's institutions are fallible and corrupt and whatever. And I think that people should recognize that they don't get their ultimate authority and legal structures from other humans, but that comes from, you know, their own view of what the moral thing is. And of course, if you believe in God, it comes from God. So it depends which group you're looking at. But clearly, I want people to know that just because a group of people in Washington say something is right and they have a bunch of guns backing them up, that doesn't mean that actually that's a just moral thing to do.
Just to so that we can close the book on what we were talking about a second ago, I'll kind of drive our listeners crazy here by jumping back into talking about quantitative easing. I don't know if I actually asked this question or if I was intending on asking it, but do the powers that be, do they have any other alternative to just more of the same? I mean, they might label it differently, but within their toolbox that they work with, without going into an ideological shift and, you know, accepting anathema, which is what would have to happen if they were to accept Austrian concepts, do they have anything in their toolbox other than more of the same?
Well, here, if let's say I just became completely amoral or whatever and George Soros or somebody said, hey, we're going to give you $100 million and we want you to get on retainer and come here and advise us as to how to take over the world. And let's suppose, you know, I'm going to speak frankly to them. The way I would explain their options to them is I would say, I think Europe is really in trouble. And the ECB at this point, European governments will go down unless the European Central Bank just starts buying up their sovereign debt. And they've already started doing this. I mean, this is a thing that's in process. So I'm saying if the ECB were to stop, major European governments would default on their debt, and a lot of banks would go down that are sitting on the debt. So the ECB could keep them going, but the euro itself is now in trouble also. And so the only way they could stop that from going down is if the Federal Reserve comes in and backs up the euro. But then ultimately, the crisis would then spread to the dollar itself. I mean, it might take another 5-10 years, but I think the situation that's hitting Europe right now eventually would then spread to the United States. And people would say, oh my gosh, the contagion's spreading, and they wouldn't know what was causing it. And, you know, Paul Krugman would say, it's because we haven't been spending enough, and it's the Austrians' fault, it's Ron Paul's fault. But clearly that's what would happen, I think. And then once the dollar collapsed, if they just kept printing and printing and printing and tried to print their way through that crisis, the dollar would collapse, and that would be it. And then they would have no more power because they had all these central banks that now aren't backed up by any, that the public just abandoned those currencies. So I think that's another, my point is they can cause a few more bubbles and just keep switching it from a sector to sector. But I think they maybe have two or three moves left like that if they are willing to keep pushing it before they just destroy the dollar itself. One thing they could do, though, if the one wild card they have is, I think if things get really bad in the United States and there start, you know, riots and people are setting cars on fire in Detroit and stuff like that, one thing they could do is they could just legalize marijuana. And then so that would clear out the prisons, and all these people would be so grateful to get, you know, their family members back home who've been locked up and so on. And then, of course, everybody would just go do that in celebration. That would calm everybody down. And there's a historical precedent. FDR, one of the first things he did when he came into office in 1933 was to legalize alcohol. Mm-hmm. And I think that that actually was part of the reason there was this little nascent recovery in terms of this, the aggregate statistics when he came in. And I don't think it was because of him going off gold and all these other things. I think one major thing, like legitimately, economically, was the federal government stopped cracking down on people from selling alcohol. And that was partly why the economy started to show signs of life. So that's what I would tell them they could do. Like, you know, when the public really starts reeling and feeling the heat from these awful policies, is you can buy yourself another year before there's an outright revolution if you legalize that. And the other advantage to them, too, depending on how conspiratorial you want to get, is then it would clear out the prisons so they could lock up the actual dissidents. You know, like mm-hmm. the people in D.C. don't actually care about some guy who sells marijuana, but they don't want somebody who's leading a resistance movement with subversive literature. They want to clear up the prisons for those guys.
And actually, you would, if you did that, you would create almost a market for, you know, because somebody has to be in those prisons. There are a lot of those prisons that are private companies that are contracted by the government. So they have to keep bodies in the beds, so to speak. So there would be a real incentive to do exactly that, wouldn't there?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. There's definitely vested powers and interests right now that benefit from the huge prison population in the United States. And a lot of people think that, and I don't know whether this is true or not empirically, but I've heard people claim that part of the opposition now to legalizing drugs isn't just coming from, you know, organized crime families who benefit from it and from the cops who are getting paid off on the side and so forth, but now also from like the unionized prison guards. And then even in the private sector, like those companies that are, like you say, making all kinds of money from these lucrative contracts where they might get paid per head. And so they obviously don't want to see a million of their potential customers, as it were, disappear because drugs get legalized.
An interesting thought, too, might be if let me set up a scenario and you tell me if I'm wrong historically about this. At close to the end of World War II, there were a lot of people in Washington, D.C. and in London that were talking about what are we going to do with all these soldiers when the war is over? We're going to have mass unemployment. We're going to destroy the economy if we bring all these soldiers in and just dump them in with nothing to do. We might even have a revolution on our hands. There was a lot of panic over this. And fortunately, government is, you know, big and dumb and slow, and they didn't move fast enough. And a bunch of those soldiers came home, were dumped into the economy, and the response was the exact opposite of what the politicians thought. It was actually a boom to the economy to have all these guys out of the military and suddenly back into the job market. Now, thinking of the prison systems, if the prisons were to open and all these nonviolent prisoners were to suddenly be out, they would all need jobs and they would all have a motivation to, you know, hammer something together and sell it or get a job or make something or start a new business or whatever. Am I completely off the tracks on that?
No, you're exactly right. So if your listeners want to see more, if you just go to Google and say Robert Murphy, The Myth of Wartime Prosperity, you'll pull up. I've recently written an article on just the sort of thing you're talking about and showing what happened with the official GDP statistics, because you're right. There were many mainstream economists who were worried that as World War II ended, with all the collapse in government expenditures and the war effort, that we'd go into it, that the depression would return, because they thought the reason they got out of the depression was because of the big military expenditures. So they thought, well, once the government pulls that spending out of the economy, we're going to sink back into it. And that isn't what happened. I mean, officially, there was a recession in 1946 because officially measured GDP did go down from 45 to 46. But if you decompose it, and that's what I do in some of these articles, you see that the private sector's share of goods and services shot up from 45 to 46, the most it has in U.S. history. And so what that's reflecting is that the government was relinquishing its control of resources, and it was going back into the private sector where it was actually being used to help people and households instead of just being used to make tanks and bombers and so forth. So in our time, you're right. If they were to open up the prisons and let all these nonviolent offenders out, just think of it in the aggregate. Like if you're just watching from outer space, that can only help total production, right? Those prisoners, when they're behind bars, they're still eating and drinking. So we're still having to keep them alive. So the part of what's produced, part of the food that's produced and so on every year has to go into their bellies right now anyway. So by letting them out, it's not like there's this extra burden now. It's not like there's more people you got to take care of. It's the same number of people. But now they're free to actually do something useful with their time instead of sitting around watching TV and lifting weights or whatever. And so it can only help in terms of total output to have more people now in the labor force. It might change wage rates in certain sectors or whatever. Individuals might end up worse off, but on net, in aggregate, more total stuff is going to get produced if you let people go get a job.
And that's exactly what we saw in the late 40s. There was a huge boom that carried really into the 50s, wasn't there?
Yeah, I mean, there were lots of things going on, and so it's hard empirically to tease out and say what caused what. I mean, there was a massive cut in government spending, so that released real resources. Yes, all these troops came back and came back into the workforce, and so output rose because of that. The people before who were overseas fighting now came back and they could do something like make cars. And so there are all those influences. I mean, one way to think about it is normally when you get more of a resource, people know that that helps your productivity, right? Like if an asteroid smashed in the ground tomorrow and had a bunch of copper, or if somebody stumbled upon a new oil field, it's not like everyone's saying, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? Now this is going to ruin the economy. So by the same token, then if all of these machines show up that happen to be organic and we call them human beings and they're the most productive, versatile things on the planet, that helps your economy, right? They look around and they say, where can I be of use? In a normally functioning, healthy market system uses price and wage signals to send them to where they ought to go. It's only when the government comes in and cripples everything that you might get a problem of massive unemployment.
Now, I want to be fair. I did not give you any idea at all in when we talked ahead of time that I was going to throw this question at you. So I apologize for not thinking of this earlier. But on a theoretical basis, then, if you had an economy of a nation and there was a neighboring nation that was struggling with its economy, and the people in that struggling nation decided, hey, you know what, let's go over there and work. And they all just, you know, in air quotes here, they illegally entered that country, flooded in and began doing, you know, work, jobs. Would that be terrible because those people from that other country are stealing our jobs? Or would it instead, as we're demonstrating here with the two examples that we've already talked about, that would be a boom to the economy? We should say, yes, bring in more of your people from your poor country and help, you know, it'll boost our economy here. The more of you poor people that come in here and work, the better off all of us are, and we all work towards a better economy. Is that crazy talk, or should we just open up and say, come on in and work?
Well, it's not crazy talk. So there's several things going on. So I personally am for not having immigration restrictions. I don't think the federal government or even state governments have any business having guys with guns standing in what I think are sort of arbitrary lines and saying, no, you're not allowed to cross over this. That if somebody wants to hire me in Mexico or let's make it more obvious, if someone in Mexico has a willing employer in the United States and he can find a landlord who's willing to rent him a room and blah, 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 who are the 51% of the voters to say, no, you can't do that? I mean, to me, that sounds crazy. Now, in reality, though, there are plenty of people who would call themselves libertarians and who are against open borders, as they would call it, because they're going to say, look, there's welfare programs. These people would come in and vote for socialists and that kind of thing. So it, the argument can get really complicated really fast. But in terms of the raw economics, which I think is the context that you want to focus on, a bunch of new workers coming in will raise total output because, like I said, it's just like if you brought in a bunch of new machines or a bunch of new natural resources, that can't make your output go down any. But it is true there could be distributional effects. So if you're an unskilled worker and then a million more unskilled workers come in, your particular lifestyle might get worse. Your standard of living might go down because your wages will get pushed down by the new workers coming in and competing for low-skilled jobs with you. And it's true, the stuff you buy at the store will get cheaper because now labor costs are lower, but the way it plays out, maybe the drop in your paycheck is more than the drop in the stuff you buy. But everybody else, the skilled workers and the people who own, you know, the property and stuff, those people all strictly benefit because their wages don't go down, but the prices of the stuff they buy go down. So the country as a whole on average is richer, but there could be specific pockets of people who genuinely do get poorer because of a massive influx of immigrants who happen to be similar to them. And so they compete with the, you know, the scarce sort of area where those people used to work.
This is kind of an argument that's been going on in the United States for a really long time. Back in the 1800s, every time there was a wave of Irish that came in or a wave of Polish or a wave of Italians, the same arguments always came back up about all this. And I think that economic aspect of it very often was twisted around, and you know, they made it sound like, oh no, all these new Irish coming in, we're gonna all have to support them. They're gonna destroy the economy. But they didn't realize that all those people have a motivation of their own. Each individual has a motivation to fill their own belly and invent something new if they can't think of any other way to do it.
Right. I mean, and again, this, some people might almost be horrified and think that I'm objectifying labor and treating people as mere commodities. But that's the point. I want to say, don't even bring in human sentiment for a moment. Just think of it in strictly rational terms and not emotional. If a million horses came in, then would that make the economy worse or better, or a million new cattle or something like that? Well, clearly that would make us richer as a nation because now we have more resources. Now, it's true if you're a cattle rancher and then a bunch of new cattle come in and your competitor gets them, you might be worse off because now the price of beef might get pushed way down. And so you might think, oh, I wish they had stopped them at the border. But the average consumer now is going to be able to buy stuff much more cheaply. And so the country as a whole clearly is richer the more resources we have to work with. And so this is the same thing with like, yeah, the Irish coming in or whatever. It's true. If you were in a certain job where now the Irish come in and they start competing for those particular jobs and you don't have any other skills, you might be made poorer. But the sort of people who buy the product that you used to make, they're going to be richer because now it's cheaper to make that product.
And then with them being richer, though, they'll do something with that money that they have, which may create another job somewhere else in the economy, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think in the long run, everybody would end up being richer because of that. Because the other thing, too, is it's not just a strictly, you know, that we all do the same type of job. And so if more people come in and you were doing that job originally, then your pay has to go down by X percent. What can happen is that can open up new niches. There can be more specialization. I mean, let me put it this way. The people who are really deathly afraid of immigrants and think that that can only hurt, well, then why don't you take the argument the other way around? Suppose there were a nuclear holocaust and you were the only person on Earth. Your standard of living would be awful because there would be no doctors. There would be no mechanics. There would be no one drilling for oil. So, yeah, you would own everything and you would die probably within a few years once you hit some situation where you personally didn't know how to deal with that. So clearly there's a sense in which and if you happen to find somebody else, you would be a lot better off. And then if you had kids and so on, you would get wealthier and wealthier as your population started growing again. So clearly there is this trade-off that the more people there are, the more they can specialize and you can have people going in certain niches and then someone can just be a brain surgeon. Whereas if you only had a population of 10, everybody would have to be foraging for food. You couldn't have someone who was devoted to studying how to be a brain surgeon. So there's that trade-off too, that as more population comes in, you can have an enhanced division of labor. And so maybe everybody, even in the short run, ends up richer.
And that, and the key word there you mentioned is division of labor. That's the concept in economics that we're talking about here. Let me pause this just for a second, save this file, and let the listeners hear another one of our lovely commercials. And we'll get right back in just a moment with Robert P. Murphy.
Want to contribute to liberty but short on cash? You can help the Freedom Fiends without even spending a post-1964 dime. Download uTorrent and start seeding Fiends episodes. Follow twitter.com/fiendtorrents to grab the past episodes and new ones as they post. Leave your computer on, seeding the torrents, while you're at work or asleep. The more people seeding the Fiends, the more drone-proof we'll be when the boot comes down. That's twitter.com/fiendtorrents.
And I'm back again with Bob Murphy, and we're talking about, well, actually, the last thing we were talking about was division of labor. And division of labor is something I think a lot of people misunderstand, but it's so fundamental to economics. You know, I love it when mostly the economists I've listened to were almost all Austrians, and very often they fall back on the story of Robinson Crusoe. And it's kind of a, you know, in ways it's overused because you hear it so often. But in other ways, when you take something, I was talking about this the other day, when you take something and you take it out to its furthest extent, that means in either directions, either take it to its most simple extent and look at it, or take it to its most to its furthest, stretch it out the farthest distance you can go in the extreme and see what it comes up with there. And you can learn a lot about that, both on the practical and the moral aspects of it. And and when you look at division of labor, I'm talking I shouldn't be talking. I should be saying, Bob, explain division of labor to me.
So it is a crucial concept, and you're right. On the one hand, it's almost so simple and intuitive that you gloss over it, but then people forget that sort of principle when they start arguing about immigration policy or things like that. So as far as just teaching it to newcomers in my principles textbook, Lessons for the Young Economist, for example, I mean, there it's something simple. It usually goes hand in hand with what's called comparative advantage, where the idea is when people specialize in certain areas and what they're really good at, then everybody benefits from it. And so I just even use real simple examples, like not even dealing with international trade, but just something simple that I think kids would even grasp to say, hey, it's the dinner's over and your parents expect you and your brothers and sisters to clean the dishes. How do you actually do it in practice? And I point out that probably one of you ends up standing by the sink. Another one maybe takes stuff from the table and scrapes it off and then hands it to that kid. And then somebody else is drying and putting it away. And I said, what you probably don't ever see is that each kid takes a plate, scrapes it, rinses it off, dries it off, and then you walk around the kitchen in counterclockwise fashion. I said, you don't ever do it that way. That would be crazy. And so notice how you specialize and one person does one task and that's all they do. And why do you do that? And I said, well, because it's just you intuitively naturally do that because that's the fastest way to clean the dishes. And especially if one of the siblings is tall and is the only one who can put the glasses on the top shelf, clearly he needs to camp out in front of that counter and be the one doing that. And so that, so just even that little analogy starts to get people to see what happens in the market economy in general, where obviously there are certain people that are just predisposed to being surgeons, right? There are some people that they don't have steady hands, and even with a lot of training, they would make awful surgeons. Or there are some people who are squeamish when they see blood. Clearly that person shouldn't be a surgeon. But even among the people that are qualified, that have the physical prerequisites, they still have to study for a long time. And so over time, the economy has to develop to the point where we can afford to have someone who, in a sense, doesn't produce anything for many years while he or she is studying in medical school and as an intern and blah, 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 until finally you have a new brain surgeon coming on out of the pipeline. In a primitive economy where everyone's living on the verge of starvation, you wouldn't have the luxury of someone being able to do that. You would need to be out in the fields picking food or whatever, going out in the woods and hunting in order to just make sure your family doesn't starve. You couldn't take off 12 years to train. And so just these sorts of things show how it is that we get to be so productive right now and why it is that with just a few hours of our labor, we can get more stuff than our ancestors could have dreamed about.
Let me add a different concept to that, and then maybe we can fold these two things together. A lot of times you hear people, especially people with more of a socialist background or a little bit on the little bit of a lefty type thinking, and they talk about how capitalism exploits the workers or capital or whatever terminology that they want to use. Essentially, there's this misunderstanding that when, you know, a person has something and they sell it to another person, somehow somebody's getting ripped off in this deal. And yet the reality of this is that if they wouldn't have both desired that trade, they wouldn't have traded. So anytime two people exchange voluntarily, of course we're talking, anytime two people exchange something voluntarily, they both come out better off than they were before. And when you take that concept and you add it with the idea that some people are better at doing things than other people, and therefore, with, you know, three people doing three different things as opposed to one person doing those three different things, when you fold those two concepts together, this is what causes civilization, essentially, right?
Yeah, I mean, Ludwig von Mises actually thought that the division of labor was the linchpin, the higher productivity that results from the division of labor was the founding bedrock upon which civilization rested, in the sense that that's why he thought we ultimately had social bonds with each other, that wasn't merely some evolutionary instinct or something, but that it just so happened that when humans cooperate with each other and can trade and then specialize and so forth, that that's just so much more productive, that the tribes or whatever that started doing that would outbreed and outproduce the ones that didn't engage in those behaviors. And that they, in Mises' case, he thought they recognized that, whereas, you know, Hayek may have thought that it could have just been a random thing and the people who happened to do that prospered. But in any event, the point is that, yes, the groups that practice the division of labor, that respect property rights, that trade with each other and base things on voluntary relationships, that in this world happens to be more productive than societies that are rife with theft and violence and so on. And so that's what modern civilization is built on.
And taking it in a different direction altogether, too, I hope I'm not bouncing around too much for you here. But I was thinking, as you were talking about violent societies, Murray famously said that the state is just basically a gang of thieves at large. And they are the Oppenheimer called them the I lost the phrase. I can't remember what he said. There was he didn't use productive class and I can't remember what Oppenheimer called it. The productive people and the people who feed off of the productive people.
Right, I know what you're talking about, and it's at the tip of my tongue too, and I can't remember it.
Anyway, but the concept is that there are essentially, if you think of it this way, don't think of class like the Marxists like to think of classes and so forth like that. If you think of it differently and you realize that there are two classes of society everywhere in the world, there are people who actually produce stuff and do things, and then there are people who essentially live off of people who produce stuff and do things. And generally, the ones that live off of others in society as we see it today, they are some form of government or governmental support of some kind. And it's all based on what Murray was talking about. It's based on a bunch of thieves that are stealing from us, and they're pulling away from the economy, not adding to it.
Yeah, it really is. It's funny. I try not to get frustrated with people because it's not healthy for me. And also it's not productive in terms of getting people to see things my way when you get angry and frustrated. But when you come to see the world the way Rothbard did through that lens, and you see the state as this parasitical institution that's literally by definition founded on coercion, right? It's not that the state just as a happenstance does things against your will. In Rothbard's view, if it were voluntary, it wouldn't be a state. It would just be a club or something. And so for him, to be a state means it gets its revenue from you against your will, that if you decided not to chip in and pay your taxes, ultimately guys with guns come and put you in a cage or they just kill you, whatever. So, and then beyond that, beyond the fact that the state rests on taking your money against your will, the things it does in practice empirically are awful. And it doesn't help. It's not like it helps the economy. Like all the things, if you see the world the way Rothbard does, all the things that the government does makes those situations worse, that the state really causes the very social problems that it then tells you it's protecting or helping with, and that's why it needs to take your money against your will. And so when you see things like that, it's sort of depressing and horrifying, and you get frustrated that other people don't see it like that. And it's just because you realize, too, this was another aspect of Rothbard's view, is that he agreed in a loose sense with Mises and others that said ultimately the government rests on public opinion, meaning in the loose sense that the reason the U.S. government is in power is not because everyone's just trembling in fear. It's because most people think that it is legitimate. And if all the public, or even just 90% of them or whatever, started thinking the way Rothbard did, the government would just kind of fall away because people would withdraw their consent. And so that's what's the frustrating thing about it, is that seeing the world the way Rothbard, seeing the state as basically an organized crime family that yet on top of it commands respect and patriotic songs and devotion from millions of Americans, that's just – it's a crazy system, and it's like, how do you break out of that?
Now, as we watch this process going on that we were talking about earlier, quantitative easing and the continual spiraling of the economy and the continual manipulation of the economy by these people, where do you project? Okay, let me put it this way. At some point, the dollar's not going to be worth anything. And that may not happen immediately. That may happen a long way down the road, or that may happen suddenly because of some stupid thing that they do. But do you see some kind of an international, like the International Monetary Fund coming in and saying, okay, from now on, you know, this is money and we have a whole new thing and some kind of a rescue comes in like that? Or what do you see on the long term in this situation?
Okay, that's a good question. Now here, I'm not so much saying that this is what I think will happen, but I think one possibility would be, and again, this is if we play devil's advocate and I pretend that Soros comes in and pays me such amount of money that I decide to give them my best advice and so on, what you could tell them is you can keep – see, look, your ultimate goal, if you're these shadowy bankers and whatever international one world types behind the scenes and you're trying to steer world events in your favor, one – ultimately what you would like is to have a central bank that just has a currency that the whole world uses. Because right now, I mean, that's part of what's going on with Europe is – part of the reason they're in trouble is that investors can dump the euro and flee into, you know, the yuan or the dollar or yen, you know, other currencies. And so if you just had one world currency that one central bank for the whole world issued, then you could get away with inflating a lot more whenever a little problem happened in the economy. You could just print money because ultimately it would take a lot to push people to just literally abandon money altogether and revert to barter, which is what they would have to do. Whereas now they don't have to give up money. They can just give up some particular currency and adopt some other money that's side by side. So I think that would help them ultimately. And so I'd say use this crisis to your advantage, that you can have the ECB keep inflating, have the Fed come in and bail them out. And then when the dollar is on the ropes and people don't know what to do, then you have the IMF or the World Bank or somebody come in and have, you know, some world currency and call it something innocuous and benign, and then have mm-hmm. and have it initially be backed up by gold. And so that would get people to flock to it. So they'd abandon their worthless fiat dollars and fiat euros and whatever, and they would take this new thing that the IMF or whoever issued, because initially it would be backed up, let's say, by a basket of commodities or something, and part of it would be gold. Then people might do that. And then once people were doing that, then 20 years down the road, you phase that out and then turn that into a fiat currency. So that would be my sinister long-term plan if I were thinking like it seems like some of these people are thinking.
And and again, let's just – this is paranoid, sinister thinking, and we're not guaranteeing any future results here. But in a situation like that, we're talking about – through this little game, we're talking about buying maybe another 50, 100, 150 years, something like this. And but we're talking about, like you're saying, a one world currency. A person who believes that the state is a good idea, a person who supports the idea that there should be a government, but a person who doesn't necessarily want to see war ravishing all around in every direction, including in his own backyard, that person would logically look at governments and say, we have too many governments in the world fighting with each other. And so wouldn't it take, if you followed the logic of the person who really believes the state is a good idea, wouldn't the perfect state be one single one world state? And I'm not trying to go into a paranoid. My regular listeners know that I'm not a big conspiracy theory type person or anything like that. But isn't that an obvious logical solution to have a one world government? And it might be divided up into, you know, segments of some kind for management purposes, but isn't that ultimately the logical destiny of believing that a state is good?
Yeah, what you're saying hits the nail on the head. And also, too, let me just reinforce your caveat. And part of even the reason I went down this path in our interview here is because I was hoping from our tone that people could tell that we sound like we're serious and we're not nut jobs. And by the same, so it's the same thing with me, that much of the stuff you will read or the videos you'll see on YouTube or whatever dealing with this stuff, I think the people who are making them are sensationalists and they're jumping to conclusions. There's all sorts of non sequiturs. But having said all that, I don't think it's completely made up. I think there really is a group of people that believe that. And the thing is, and this goes along with what you're saying, it's not because they're necessarily these evil people sitting behind the scenes laughing like Dr. Evil. It's because you could understandably look at the world today and say, how do we get rid of all this massive starvation and all this conflict and all this warfare? If we just had one group that was in charge of everything, there wouldn't be the need for all this fighting. And so I could see, and you're right, and that is the logical fruition of someone who thinks there should be a state covering the current geographical boundary region of the United States, for example. And that's actually an argument I use. I'm teaching a class right now on anarcho-capitalism, and that's one of the arguments I use, that when people who say stuff like, oh, anarcho-capitalism is crazy because you need to have one set of laws that apply to everybody, and in your wacky system, there might be different legal codes applying to these people over here and these people over here. The first reaction I give as an anarcho-capitalist to that objection is to say, well, right now, are you happy with there being one set of rules for the U.S. and a different set of rules for Mexico and a different set of rules for France? Because unless you believe in one world government and think that ultimately you want Americans to be subject to one government that rules the entire earth, then how can you object to me thinking that people in this neighborhood should have the ability to go to a different court from people in this neighborhood over here? So yeah, just to close that train of thought, I'm agreeing with you that if you believed conventionally in a state that should apply to Americans right now, and you thought it made sense that there could be a nation state of the Mexicans and of the Canadians and blah, 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 that really that system is sort of unstable, and you should at least in principle think logically, if you know other things equal, it would make more sense. It would be more orderly and coherent if we had just one government running all of Earth.
And again, I want to emphasize that we're not talking about a committee of people living in some French chateau somewhere with cloven hooves that are carefully rubbing their hooves together, planning out the demise of humanity. This is just taking logic through its course and seeing, you know, what are they thinking? How would these things come about, and what other options are there? And I don't see, from a statist point of view, I don't see any other possible option other than to go in that direction.
Yeah, and maybe another way to sort of, and this I think is a good illustration of the difference between the true conspiratorial narrative that I think goes too far versus what's more realistic but accurate. So there are some people that they'll look at the growth in government from, you know, 1800 to today, And they'll describe that as if the people in 1800 were looking ahead 170 years and said, oh, in 1970, we want this to happen, so let's start the train. And I don't think that's the way it happened, because just for one thing, people are so unpredictable that you couldn't possibly set in motion a plan back then that was going to take into account all of world history for the next 100 years. There's too much unpredictability. Right. But the logic of the state and of people seeking power is whenever you're in office, you want to have more power. That, I mean, other things equal, if you're the president, you want to have a strong executive branch. Why wouldn't you? You'd always want to have the ability to do more stuff when you're the one in the White House. And so what does that mean? But that's true of anyone who's in the White House. So we shouldn't be surprised that over time, the executive branch keeps getting stronger and stronger. And you don't have to assume that Theodore Roosevelt was thinking, I want to make sure the guy who's in the White House in 2004 has these powers, so I'm going to start busting up trusts. That you don't have to have that element of it. It can just be whoever's in power at the time wants more. And what does that mean? That means over time there's this gradual accumulation of power in the hands of fewer and fewer people. So like you say, there doesn't even need to be this grand conspiracy, but world events certainly are moving towards bigger and bigger jurisdictions for these now what are supranational agencies that have the ability to do things that are not just confined to national boundaries. And this, you know, this isn't crazy talk. There's all kinds of stuff that you can point to in the New York Times about how the U.S., you know, what used to be considered U.S. sovereignty is now being shared among different groups and so on. I mean, so we're not – and clearly what's happening in Europe is national sovereignty is getting overridden because of this financial crisis. And now international groups are telling governments this is what you have to do with your budget, because if they don't, then they're going to, you know, cut them off and let their currency or let their government's debt collapse and so on. So, I mean, this situation certainly is being molded in this panic that's unfolding right now to give – to concentrate power into smaller and smaller groups of people.
I'm afraid, you know, I could go on talking to you like this literally for hours, because this is just the kind of thing that I thrive on. I love to do this, especially with somebody like yourself. I'm doing the same thing. I was talking about a year ago to Robert Higgs, and we were having similar conversations. And it's just – it's the kind of thing that I could do for hours. Unfortunately, we've already ran over our time limit. Bob, is there anything you want to tell the people, you know, websites, books, anything like that, that they can find out more about you?
Sure. So look me up on Facebook. I'm Robert P. Murphy. I live in Nashville, and my blog is consultingbyrpm.com.
Thanks very much for coming on the show with me, Bob. And I want to extend an open invitation to you anytime, you know, like tomorrow, 6 months from now, whatever. This is always going to be an open mic for you. I really enjoyed having you on the show. And folks, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. Thank you very much for listening today.